This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is artist and singer Melissa Newman, one of the five daughters of actor Paul Newman, who died in 2008. She's here to talk about her dad's candid memoir, Paul Newman, The Extraordinary Life of an Ordinary Man. It was compiled from interviews he gave to a close friend, and it sheds light on the self-doubt of the seemingly cool and calm Hollywood legend who was a deeply private man living an intensely public life. His daughter is Zooming with me today from Connecticut. Melissa, welcome to Book Talk.
How are you doing? Nice to have myself here.
Yeah, good. How did your dad's memoir come about?
It's a very interesting story. Stuart Stern was a very good friend of his. He was a screenwriter who wrote the screenplay for Rebel Without a Cause. He was a really good friend of my parents. He wrote screenplays that my father was in, television screenplays. He actually met my father 12 days before my father met my mother. He may have loved my father even more than my mother loved my father. And I think that when my father met my mother, I think Stuart was really jealous, and Stuart and my mother developed an incredibly deep relationship out of the frustration of loving my father. They were bonded. They ended up being even closer. But Stuart, in a strange way, you know, in the memoir, there's a lot of discussion about the fact that my father's mother objectified him. And in a strange way, I think Stuart put my father on a pedestal. Stuart was an extraordinary man. He was his godfather, my son's godfather. I was very, very close to him. And when he died at the age of 93.
And you mentioned your mother. Your mother's the very famous movie star, Joanne Woodward.
Stuart really wanted to do this. I'm not sure how my dad felt, but Stuart did an incredible job of interviewing people. They talked about writing biographies. My dad knew no one else could do it but Stuart. They wrote a biography. He interviewed 100 different people, and there were, you know, all these transcripts that we knew, and we participated in this. We knew the transcripts existed. And then they just sort of, you know, disappeared for a while. And then we eventually found them after my dad passed away. There were some in a closet upstairs. Our friend Emily Wachtel was the one who really took a deep dive and found them and got the locksmith. And there they were. And then we had to figure out how we were going to move forward with them.
Who are some of the other voices in this memoir?
Well, there was an interesting discussion. I think that at one point, the editors were so enamored of my father's voice that they really just wanted to include that. But the fact of the matter is, my dad and Stuart even discuss, in this very meta fashion, discuss the making of the book in the transcript. So they discuss how they would, various ways in which they would like to put it together. And my dad certainly said that he would use all these other voices as a jumping off point, and that he liked the idea of there being one voice on one side of the page and his voice on another, not in a contentious way, but just, he said, to prove that there was, he said, the light that you think you're emanating isn't the light that other people necessarily see. And he thought it was interesting to have both things on either side of the page, and that it was proved that there is no reality.
Who were some of those other Hollywood people, right?
They were, Stuart managed to dig up all these people. There were directors. There were, you know, Robert Altman, and John Foreman was, you know, his producer. I was just saying that they, you know, at one point they just wanted to use my dad's voice, but I love the way that the other voices balance out. So I really, really promoted this idea that, you know, he did say that that's what he wanted. The transcripts are so fascinating, the back and forth and the questions and the digging.
Along with your dad's Hollywood career, he was also a race car driver and a philanthropist. His obituary in The Economist, I saw this in the book, noted he was the most generous individual relative to his income in the 20th century history of the United States.
Wow, coming from The Economist, you've got to believe that's true, right?
What was his favorite charity?
The thing I love about him was the breadth of charities that he gave to. If something happened, I think that was his delight, and is that he could respond to, you know, he could respond to things. But there was, you know, it was political. There was, you know, so many different issues that you can't even really quantify it. But he, you know, he started the hole in the wall gang camps, and I love to talk about them. I'm on the board of the original camp. My little sister is an ambassador for the Serious Fund Children's Network. He started this camp for kids with life-threatening diseases, and the First one was in Ashford, Connecticut. And then now there are, I think there are a total of 30 and they're all over the world. And he would go there. And the thing he loved about it was that the kids have no, they don't know anything about him except that he was the guy that started camp. And so he's revered for that reason. And I think, you know, for a man who said, you know, he loved to say that my epitaph will read, "Here lies Paul Newman, who died a failure because his eyes turned brown," that just being appreciated for something so direct. And as he would say too, like it was, he had this idea and then people just started coming to this idea, but the camps are extraordinary. And anybody who wants to look up the hole in the wall gang camp to see kids unstrapping their prosthetic legs and throwing them on the ground and doing a climbing wall, kids plugging up their feeding tubes and rolling into the swimming pool in a wheelchair, kids that actually can have like tube feedings because they can sleep in a cabin that's right connected to an infirmary with doctors and nurses. And it's all fully, fully funded. Nobody pays a cent and it's all funded by donations. So anybody who wants to feel good, go look that up on YouTube, because there's great videos and you'll get a sense of it. And I think that was the purest iteration of his legacy. And you know, it's just extraordinary. It was a really happy place for him. So if I was going to have to answer one, I would say Hole in the Wall.
Hole in the Wall.
Yeah. And the Serious Fund Children's Network, just extraordinary and lives on.
I also read in your book that he won his last race car race when he was 82.
Yes. 83, I think. Really? And it was September. He wound up at Lime Rock, which was his home track in Connecticut. And the race was on September 29th of 07. And he died on September 26th of 08. And I was there, and his friend, he was duking it out with his friend, Michael Brockman, because the lead guy spun out. And then he and Brock duked it out for the lead. And I asked Brock later, I said, "Did you take your foot off the pedal?" And he said, "Are you kidding me? Your dad would have killed me if I had done that." And they just named the back straightaway at Lime Rock after my dad, called Newman's Straight. And my mother, as he said, my mother deplored the whole thing, but she was, you know, she supported it because he loved it. And she would just sit there on a hill and knit like a maniac while he was going round and round and round. And he loved, you know, the thing is, another thing, he loved race car drivers because he had to prove himself.
What's the most important feature of this book for you?
For me, you know, there were two reasons that he stated that he wanted to do this. One of that he didn't want anyone messing with his work. But the thing that I really appreciate about it is he also said he wanted to leave a record for the children and the grandchildren. One of my sons has read the book. I think the other one, he hasn't read it yet. But, you know, to them, it's really fascinating. And they've got the incredible, not to mention 14,000 pages of transcripts that when they're ready, they have full access to. But, you know, that they have this wonderful condensed version of, you know, their history.
Right.
Pretty extraordinary.
It is.
Yeah.
Is there anything we didn't cover that you would like to add?
Oh dear. Yeah, I think maybe the one thing I think that the editors really chose to sort of focus on this very internal dark narrative in the book. And I think it's really fascinating. And I think that, you know, what's fascinating about it is that, you know, is that it does show the fragility and the insecurity of someone that, you know, when you only see the surface. And I've always felt like when I envision my father, I envision a giant billboard of a movie star with a man down at the bottom waving and saying, I'm here, you know. But, you know, there's also an incredible amount of balance. There's other stuff in the transcripts that's about acting and about methods and about, you know, there's so many other layers. And I'm kind of sorry that the book can't be, you know, 9,000 pages, because I think there's probably another book, but I don't think I have it in me to do that. But, you know, there might be a play in it someday. Like that whole conversation between him and Stuart Stern is really extraordinary. It's a documentation of a really interesting, complicated friendship as well, which is really cool. So, you know, it's been really, really interesting. My kids are very lucky. They got to spend a considerable amount of time with him. My son Peter was 12 when he passed away, and my son Henry was 9. And he got kind of a do-over because I had boys and, you know, because my brother passed away when he was 26 from a drug overdose. And so when I had two boys, you know, all I can say is seeing my dad in a sandbox with, you know, a three-year-old and a bunch of toy cars is to see my dad truly being himself.
Thank you. My guest is Melissa Newman, speaking with me today about her dad's memoir, Paul Newman, The Extraordinary Life of an Ordinary Man, published by Knopf. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.